There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, and welcome to New Scientist Weekly, your curated selection of the week's science stories. I'm Christy Taylor in New York.
And I'm Rowan Hooper in London. Welcome to the show. This week on the podcast, we've got a story about devices that assemble themselves using the quantum fluctuations in empty space, which sounds wild, and we are actually going wild. We've got some fascinating research into how animals communicate. Listen to this. That is a wolf in Yellowstone, and we'll be hearing more from that wolf later. Plus, how the most extensive tree of life yet could tackle what Darwin called the abominable mystery.
And then, of course, some of my favorite good news of the week. Voyager 1 is back, baby.
Yeah.
But first, election season has begun in India, where Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his BJP party are campaigning for another term in power. Indians have already begun voting and will continue through June when votes will be tallied up. In the mag this week, we've been taking a look at some of the biggest tech and science stories in India and how they may be impacted by election results, including healthcare and India's ambitions in the chip manufacturing space. Now, notably, this year's election is also happening during a heat wave so intense that it's disrupting the ability of people to even get to the polls.
It's 44 degrees Celsius, and that's 111 Fahrenheit. Absolutely horrendous and really dangerous, as we know.
Yeah, and this ties almost too perfectly into our next story. What happens in India also has big implications for global climate change. Just last year, India overtook the European Union as the third largest annual emitter of greenhouse gases, and its emissions are expected to rise in coming decades more than any other country. India is also one of the most vulnerable places in the world when it comes to the effects of more extreme heat and weather, again, as this heat wave is showing us. And trusty climate reporter James Dineen is here. Hey, James.
Hi there.
So, James, what is or isn't Modi's government doing about India's rising emissions?
So the short answer is building a lot of renewable energy, but it's not happening fast enough, and Modi's government continues to support the expansion of coal power. So it's a mixed bag. But just to step back a little bit, Modi's climate story really starts with India joining the Paris Agreement in 2015, just a year after his administration came to power. Since then, his administration has pledged that India will reach net zero emissions by 2070 and has set some near-term renewable energy targets, like building 500 gigawatts of renewable energy capacity by 2030. And those targets are slower than China and the U.S., the two top emitters. But many see the slower targets as justified given India's smaller share of historical emissions. India is responsible for only around 3% of cumulative emissions, and its per-person emissions are also much lower than the global average.
Now, can those per-person emissions stay low if, you know, as you said, India is continuing to invest in expanding coal?
Yeah, that's a good question. Another crucial point of context there is that many people in India currently lack access to sufficient energy. So energy demand is expected to soar as more people gain access and start using more of it for things like air conditioning, which is a technology that saves lives during the kind of heat waves India is experiencing right now. And it's worth saying more heat will also mean running air conditioners more. But just to put India's projected power demand into perspective, The International Energy Agency projects India will have to add an entire European Union worth of power generation in just the next two decades to meet that demand.
Wow.
So a lot of India's decarbonization challenge comes down to meeting that surging demand for energy while limiting emissions.
So how an entire EU worth of energy, how on earth are they doing that? How are they going about that?
Well, a few ways. One, renewable energy is booming on the subcontinent, especially solar energy. India added a record 15 gigawatts of new solar generation in the past year, and this March actually just set a new monthly record. And now renewable energy, including solar, hydropower, and wind, makes up about a third of India's mix. There's also growing adoption of electric vehicles, especially those smaller two-wheelers. And there are ambitious plans to become a green hydrogen powerhouse. And all that has made some difference. At the same time, India remains behind target. For instance, despite the record solar power additions this past year, meeting the 2030 renewable target would require adding 50 gigawatts of new capacity each year. And they're at 15 gigawatts now. One issue is that India sources most of its solar panels from China, but this has become more expensive due to tariffs that are a result of some geopolitical tensions between the two countries. The other way India is meeting that surging demand, there's been a slew of announcements about extending the life of coal power plants and building new ones to meet energy demand. Some of those announcements came after heat waves led to power shortages in 2022 and 2023 that put pressure on politicians. So it's not clear how many of those coal power plants will be built. And there's an active debate about whether this new coal power is needed to meet future energy demand. But that's all to say the new coal announcements really challenge the narrative that India is making rapid progress towards net zero by 2070.
So what about in the US? You know, we're looking at the prospect of Donald Trump being elected later in the year. And there's that report predicting that if Trump is elected, the carbon emissions would lead to climate damages costing more than $900 billion. So obviously the stakes in the US are huge on the US election. And I wondered what the stakes are in India. Does it matter that much which party wins?
Yeah, it's a different story in India. Interestingly, the people I spoke with really explained that action on climate change isn't really at issue in India's national election, at least. They really felt India's efforts on renewable energy and other aspects of decarbonization would basically continue apace whoever wins. I found a big survey from 2022 that found large majorities of Indians are both worried about climate change and support taking action to stem India's emissions, like building more renewables and expanding forests. So that's good news in some sense.
Great. Well, let's end it on that good news tone. Mm-hmm. I also want to mention that we've got much more coverage of the state of major science and tech issues in India this week, and we'll link in the show notes. That's newscientist.com/podcasts.
For the next segment, we are going to examine animal communication. Remember that wolf howl you heard earlier? Yep, that's what we're doing now. Arik Kirschenbaum is a zoologist at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He studies vocal communication in a range of different animals in the wild. And he's just written a book, Why Animals Talk, The New Science of Animal Communication. And Rowan has been hearing all about it.
Arik, thanks for joining us. You've just got back from Nepal, I hear, which, I mean, even before hearing that, I was very envious of your job traveling the world and trying to understand animals in the wild. And you study many different species, and we're going to hear some of them. But before then, I wondered if you could perhaps sum up your book for us and tell us what you set out to do.
Yeah, the book is about why animals talk, not just what they say or what they mean. It's how that happened. Why is there such a diversity of animal sounds in the world? You're quite right. Every place I've been, a jungle, mountain, desert, you know, you have all these animal sounds, and they're all different. And these animals are all saying different things. And the way they got to that state where some of them need to say more, some of them need to say less, it's a really fascinating evolutionary story.
I mean, one theme that seemed to come out in your book is sociality. It's a very pleasing theme to draw from it, actually, that one of the drivers of communication seems to be being social. Is that right?
Well, of course, communication is between to individuals in the most cases, or more so. Sociality's got to be a part of it. But I think a lot of people don't understand quite the depth to which sociality defines communication, or more particularly, it's really the complexity of sociality that drives complex communication. There are animals that communicate simply, animals that communicate in a more complicated way, but the reason they would need to communicate in a more complicated way is because they've got all these complicated social interactions and they're trying to mediate all of the interactions between their friends and their enemies, who they're going to cooperate with, who they're going to compete with, and so on.
Okay, let's hear some animals. We're going to start with wolves. You've worked with wolves a lot. This is a wolf chorus. It does sound very dog-like, actually, to me. What's going on there?
Well, one of the fantastic things about wolves is that although we know that these are long-range signals, you know, howling across the mountains to their distant colleagues, but they also howl when they're all together. And it's this sort of joyous, communal interaction where they just really enjoy all howling together. And a lot of it is down to the fact that they are sort of reaffirming the comfort that they draw from each other and from being together in a pack.
Mm. We've got a solitary wolf howling now. This is a timber wolf howling. That is just such an incredible noise, isn't it? What's it like being in the wilderness and hearing that and knowing that there's that predator not far away from you?
It's the most wonderful experience to know that, you know, those animals that you want to study and you want to understand are out there, they're around you. And really, that's the only way to understand what's going on. It's the only way to understand animals is to see them in their world, in their environment. It's a very soothing and really very emotional sound.
It is, isn't it? It is emotional. And not just because of the horror movies that it invokes, but just for its own sake. I think that was in Yellowstone National Park, wasn't it, that wolf? So what's going on there with that solitary howl?
What you can hear in that solitary howl, very typical of a lot of wolf howls, is the way the pitch goes up and down. It goes up and then down a bit and then down a bit more. And it's that sort of signature of changes in the pitch that really can contain information. What information it contains, it's not that clear. It could be information about the individual. It could be information about which pack it comes from. It can also be information just about how the animal is feeling. Lonely, looking for its pack mates, perhaps found food, looking to hunt. So all that kind of information can be transferred over long distances using those pitch changes in the howl.
It's funny, when you said lonely, I instantly felt it was lonely because listening to the tone of its howl. But then I thought, well, that's a very human emotion I'm giving to that wolf. You know, how do you separate our just sort of natural instinct to look at animal noises through how we would feel about it?
When you're thinking about the difference between humans and animals, it's important to differentiate between emotions and rationality. Animals have emotions. Animals have more emotions than humans do. It's the rationality that distinguishes humans from animals, not the emotions. Mm. And in particular, when you have a very social species like wolves who live together in a group, who have to live together to survive, then obviously being separated from that group is a negative experience for them. It's a negative emotional experience for them that we choose to give a label like loneliness.
All right, let's go to another animal now. This is a hyrax. And before we talk about what it is, for people listening, see if you can guess what it is. I mean, I would have thought that was maybe a frog or then a bird. Eric, what is a hyrax?
Hyrax is a little, small, furry animals, small mammals that really, I suppose, on the outside, they look a little bit like a giant guinea pig. They're not really related to any other mammals that are alive today, except perhaps elephants, about the size of a rabbit. And they are extremely, extremely vocal animals, as are many animals, in fact, in the world.
What is the hyrax doing there then? And where do they live? They live in social groups and they're communicating by calling out to each other. Is that what's going on?
Hyraxes live across Eastern Africa, Eastern Southern Africa and into the Middle East. They live in large groups, usually consists of a male and several females. And this is the male singing to advertise his territory. But more than that, he's advertising his dominance. He's advertising how powerful he is, warning away other males, warning away younger males who may want to challenge him. So it's really an expression of how powerful the individual is. And he expresses that using the complexity of his song. The more complex his song, then the more powerful he is.
Yeah, so we're getting an increase in complexity here. And I'm starting to think about the border between a complex signal and a language. So let's just talk about that a bit when we hear the next animal, which is a gibbon. And this one is, it's just incredible the way it builds up. Let's hear that. That's just this really ethereal sound, isn't it? And then the crescendo it builds up to. What's going on there?
It is a wonderful sound, and it really permeates the jungle, and it's quite an incredible wake-up call. In fact, that's the call of the Calvid gibbon, which is a very rare gibbon. But all gibbons sing, they sing between the males and the females. So those first calls were the calls of the male, and then that crescendo was the reply of the female.
Wow.
And all gibbons have this very complex song. We don't exactly know why it needs to be so complex. It certainly has elements that could contain quite a lot of meaning. But we think that fundamentally it evolved as a male-female interaction, as a way to strengthen the family bond, to advertise the group's territory, and so on. We do know that in other gibbon species, in white-handed gibbons, for instance, there is extra information in those calls. There can be information about predators, information about resources. But the complexity here, in the case of the gibbons, certainly has the capacity to contain information, but not language.
I cannot believe that gibbon song wasn't birdsong.
It's amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was Arik Kirschenbaum, and his book Why Animals Talk is out now in the UK. Out in the US, coming soon in August.
Let's take a moment to tell you about a special live event for our US listeners this summer. Have you always wanted to understand human consciousness? I know I have. Maybe you're stuck in a loop right now, wondering about how that squishy lump of meat in your skull is capable of learning and wondering about itself.
Well, as they say, come on down to a special day-long event that's all about the latest research, theory, and understanding of how our brains do the seeming magic of sentience. You'll meet and learn from leading experts in neuroscience and philosophy, hear about groundbreaking new science, and come away more conscious than ever before. That's on June 22nd in New York City. For more information, visit newscientist.com/newyorkmind.
And if you're looking for something fun in the meantime, maybe you have FOMO about missing the solar eclipse a couple of weeks ago, Dead Planet Society has you covered. What if you could engineer our planetary system so that there was always a total eclipse somewhere? Chelsea White and Leah Crane find out how that could possibly work and, you know, what could go wrong. That's coming Tuesday.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Our next story is about creating tiny devices through an assembly process that includes some unusual tools. And these are quantum fluctuations hiding in what you only think is empty space. Carmela Padovich-Callahan, thank God you're here to help us understand, as always. Hi, Carmela.
Hello.
Hi. So look, this is unusual even by your standards, actually. What are we talking about? Empty space, you know, empty space, but it's still doing something active.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a little wild, but this is exactly what we are talking about. I reported on an experiment this week where researchers wanted to build these tiny gold cavities, sort of like two gold flakes with some space in the middle where you can trap light. And these are sort of a common building block for various light manipulating experiments. That's not the weird part. The weird part is that instead of using some sort of instrument or maybe like tweezers made of light or, you know, something physics-y like that to make these cavities, they use something that's called the Casimir effect. And the Casimir effect directly follows from quantum theory, which tells us that there's actually no such thing as empty space. What there is instead of empty space is this sort of like soup of particles and antiparticles that are flickering in and out of existence. So on average, when you look at empty space, it looks like there's nothing there. But really, even if you were to remove every single atom from anywhere, it would still be teeming with these sort of quantum flickers.
Oh, that's absolutely wild. So we've got empty space that's actually full of these imperceptible flickers coming in and out of existence. How do you then go about, you know, harnessing that, making it do something?
Yeah, I mean, so the most simple version of the Casimir effect says that if you have two reflective plates and you put them very close together, the flickers in the gap between them will have sort of a net effect of pulling the two plates closer to each other. It will look like there's a force pulling them closer. Mm. And this new experiment wanted to take advantage of that force to sort of bring one of the gold flakes that makes up the cavity above the other one and assemble them in that way.
I feel like I just have a version of the same question, which is once we get to this really precise, tiny level of gold flakes, how do you make quantum flickers do exactly precisely
right.
what you
yeah.
want?
Right. That's exactly the question. Like, you can't just rely on things flickering and moving around. You have to take control. Mm-hmm. And what the researchers did here is they also added the electrostatic force in the mix. So they used these sort of two triangular pieces of gold, these tiny flakes, which are going to be the two parts of their cavity. They started with one triangular gold flake embedded in a piece of glass. That would be the bottom of their cavity. And then to add the top part of the cavity, they took more of these gold flakes, mixed them with water and salt, and then they put that on top of the glass. What that does is that you have the Casimir effect between the two pieces of gold, which pulled the loose flake towards the one that was embedded in the glass, and it made them align. It's sort of an attractive force, the Casimir force. But then you also get the electrostatic force from the charges of the salt that was dissolved in the water. And the electrostatic force balanced out the Casimir force just right so that the flakes stop moving. And now you've got like a bottom triangle and a top triangle, and this is your cavity fully assembled.
That's so amazing. So just to recap, they mixed gold, glass, salt, and water, which sounds like alchemy, honestly. And they ended up with this useful little cavity for free. So did it end up actually working the way it should once it was made?
It worked really well, actually. The researchers could trap light between the two flakes just like they wanted. And they could also add more salt or less salt into the mixture to change the separation between these two cavities, because this changed the electrostatic force. And the very cool thing about this is that as you change the size of the cavity, the light that's trapped inside it that sort of bounces between the flakes changes color. So I was talking to one of the researchers and she basically showed me all these images of sort of like red, pink, green, blue glow that you can get in different runs of the experiment. And you can see by eye that you're messing with the forces correctly because the color changes.
I mean, I love that they're using this force, and but it does seem like they've gone to quite a lot of trouble to make a tiny little gold cavity. And it's nice that they've done it and all, but is there any other reason to do this?
Yeah, I mean, so for one, you know, they've verified that this method works and that they can do it very precisely, which really opens the door to try and assemble more complicated things. So maybe you want to build a device that can manipulate light in some very complicated way. So maybe you want a color and then you want to change something else about it. Now this is giving you a way to do it for free, sort of just like by having it in this salty water solution. You could build something more complicated by using the same method and using this cavity as a building block. And then you could also think about putting something else inside of the cavity and seeing what happens to it when light keeps hitting it over and over again. And then finally, this is a way to produce like light of the color that you want out of something very small. And again, sort of for free, just by mixing stuff together. So maybe, you know, you could use this as a light source for some other experiment.
Not to mention the wonder and joy of harnessing a quantum force in empty space.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel, you know, some people have to like learn how to use pipettes and stuff. And here we are just being like, empty space is going to do it for us.
All right, big news for plant science enthusiasts this week. Botanists have mapped what's known as a tree of life for over 9,500 species of flowering plants, giving us the most detailed look at the origins and evolutionary history of these plants to date. Chen Lai is here with the story. Hey, Chen.
Hi.
So let's start with the basics. What is a tree of life, and why is it so important for understanding a particular group of life forms?
So like the name suggests, a tree of life is this kind of big graphical description of all the evolutionary relationships between organisms, with tree-like branches denoting where different families or genera have split off in the past. So basically, a very organized way of making sense of a lot of information, allowing plant scientists to easily track the history and compare different organisms over time.
So what did they do here to get this tree of life, and why focus on flowering plants in the first place? Why are they an important thing to understand better?
For the past 8 years, scientists at Kew Gardens have set out on a mammoth task of making the trees of life for all known genera of plants and fungi, starting with angiosperms, which are flowering plants. Why they're so important is that they make up about 90% of all plants on land, which is most of the plants you see in your day-to-day life as you walk down the street. And they play a vital role in maintaining the Earth's system, so notably, you know, making oxygen and storing carbon, as well as making up the bulk of what we eat. So potatoes, rice, wheat, corn, they're all angiosperms.
Yeah, just underpin all life on Earth and support us all.
Yeah.
So what did
No big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. I mean, how did they go about doing this, building a tree of life for, you know, just angiosperms?
Yeah, so the first thing we need to do to figure out the tree of life is to sequence their DNA. So to do that, the team of researchers at Kew Garden, alongside many other researchers around the world, created a set of probes to find 353 specific genes that appear in all species of angiosperms. They then compare the genetic sequences within these genes to each other to figure out which ones are the most similar, which ones are different, which they can then use to plot on the tree of life. So far, we've plotted 9,506 species on the tree of life, which encompasses nearly all angiosperm families and about 8,000, around 60% of all known genera of flowering plants.
Wow. Okay. So look, this is a huge feat, and you know what, a lot of work must have gone into it. And I actually love that Kew are behind this, because you know, there's a really lovely link between Darwin and Kew, because his best friend was the director of Kew Gardens back in the day, Joseph Hooker. And Darwin wrote this letter to Hooker, not that long before he died, before Darwin died, about something that was tormenting him. And that was the sudden appearance of flowering plants in the fossil record. And they just pop up. And that tormented Darwin, because, you know, how do you explain that through his theory of natural selection? And he called it an abominable mystery. So the big question is, does this really detailed tree help us get to the any closer to this mystery?
Yeah, I mean, I really love that you brought that up, because God, what this tree does is being able to track the history of and the origins of flowering plants we confirm that this abominable mystery is really a thing. So Charles Darwin wasn't tormented by an imaginary, something imaginary. What we do confirm is that 80% of all major flowering plant lineages that are still around today were part of this early burst of angiosperm diversity. Of course, it doesn't quite solve the mystery of why it happened, but in any case, a more comprehensive understanding and look at angiosperm history will hopefully help us solve the mystery in the future.
Okay, let's end this week by celebrating the most distant human-made object in existence.
Yeah, Voyager 1, one of my two favorite spaceships currently hurtling away from the solar system.
Yeah, the other being Voyager 2. But look, we want to talk about Voyager 1 because a few days ago, after 5 months of radio silence, NASA made contact again with the spacecraft. And, you know, just think about how far away it is. It's 15 billion miles away in interstellar space. That's 24 billion kilometers. And the unit of measurement I prefer for these things is light hours. So it's 22.44 light hours away.
And that's also about how long it takes to receive and send texts to and from Voyager 1 at this point is 22 hours.
Yeah,
and just to recap the epic story of Voyager 1, it launched 46 years ago in 1977. It gathered a lot of really vital data on the outer planets and then continued onward to the edge of the solar system. About 10 years ago, it crossed this thing called the heliopause, which is the spot where space stops being dominated by hot particles and wind from our sun and then starts to be dominated by the colder, denser interstellar plasma. And we actually have some spine-tingling sounds on the show this week to sort of demonstrate that. That noise you can hear now, it's the sound of the plasma of interstellar space as recorded by Voyager 1.
Wow. Yeah, I thought you couldn't hear things in space. but that is
unless you sonify your data.
Oh, right. Okay. Look, I think the whole Voyager story is really quite moving, isn't it? I mean, it was a 5-year mission. It just kept going on and on. And, you know, it's an ancient bit of technology. It's incredible. It's a real testament to the way it was built, the foresight to be able to build something that you were still able to repair and work on 46 years later.
I feel like this is one of those things where the adage, they don't make things like they used to, really comes in here. This is really one of those missions that speaks to having been well built from the start. But this latest loss of contact and the fix is maybe even more impressive in some ways. Just to sort of recap the tech, it's got 3 computers on board with only 70 kilobytes of memory total. That's kilobytes with a K, because this is 1970s technology we're talking about. And Rowan, maybe not that you need a reminder, but 70 kilobytes is easily smaller than many single images you might find on the internet these days. So what happened was one of the chips that was responsible for communicating data back to Earth got corrupted, which means that engineers had to move the code from that chip to other locations on the 3 tiny memoried computers. But they couldn't put it all in one place. They had to actually like distribute this code across different chips and locations. And so that means they also had to rewrite the code to reference all of the different locations where the different parts of that code ended up. It's fiendishly complicated sounding. And Chris Hadfield, the retired astronaut, he said it was kind of like fixing your fancy vintage car when it's also 15 billion miles away from you.
Yeah. I mean, Chris Hadfield's famous for playing David Bowie songs on the ISS, isn't he?
Yeah.
I don't think there's any Bowie on the Golden Record, but Voyager contains the Golden Record, which is this famous store of sounds and languages and music from Earth. And it includes a song, you know, for example, by the bluesman from the 1920s, Blind Willie Johnson.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Golden Record. And I mean, the idea of that was to communicate something, ideally as much as possible, about humanity if aliens ever find it, right? A Carl Sagan special.
Yeah, I mean, that is NASA's stated aim about it. But, you know, do they really believe that an alien's going to do that? Or was it more a way of, you know, just celebrating humanity? You know, and I guess when I think about it like that, I think that's why I find the story of Voyager so moving, that it's, you know, it represents something really incredible that we've managed to get out of the solar system in this sense. But I just want to take the opportunity to quote Josh from The West Wing here on Blind Willie Johnson. So Blind Willie, he was blinded by his stepmother at age 7.
And Josh has this line where he goes, he died penniless of pneumonia after sleeping bundled in wet newspapers in the ruins of his house that burned down. But his music just left the solar system. And that's just, wow.
Well, and I know one of our editors was even saying earlier this week that Voyager is the mission that refuses to die. But I want to say it's kind of extremely fitting for a mission that also set out to memorialize and share some of our highest minded arts and ideals. I mean, it just kind of seems right that it keeps going as long and as far as possible.
That's all for this week. You can read all the stories we've talked about today in the show notes, and there's much more like it on our website, newscientist.com.
Plus, if you like the stories we're bringing you, please give us a rating or review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Yep.
It's all in service of the algorithm, but the algorithm hopefully will serve us. Share your favorite stories, tell your nerdy friends, put it on a paper airplane and throw it out the window. We'll be back next week. Bye for now.
Bye.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.